Tradio, nourishing the soul of the digital generation.
Hi, I'm Sarah, and you're listening to Cradio. By now, you would have heard the reports about last weekend's March for the Babies in Melbourne, where a group of abortion advocates attempted to derail the efforts of more than 3,000 pro-lifers who turned out to peacefully protest the 2008 Victorian Abortion Law Reform Act. Video clips captured by media and attendees have circulated on the internet showing scenes of conflict and chaos. We spoke to Therese Shamoon, a first-time attendee, to find out what happened.
March for the Babies was an event consisting of many pro-lifers around Australia, I imagine mostly Melburnians, who wanted to express their, I guess, disappointment at the current state in Australia, our laws, which allow abortion practically up until term. I think most of the attendees wanted to express their disappointment and their disagreement with the current laws.
Had you attended this event previously?
No, I actually haven't. It was my first march. I have been told that it's previously been a much more peaceful event, and it was surprisingly a bit confronting, actually, for me, very confronting, to say the least.
So what actually happens on the march?
We started from Treasury Gardens and we went down Flinders Street, but we were surprisingly stopped at around Federation Square by a counter rally of about 50 or so people, and we stopped there for about 45 minutes because they were quite adamant that our message wouldn't get across. It seemed that they were really disturbed by the pro-life message, and therefore we had to turn back after 45 minutes. It became quite dangerous to stay. It was determined that it was dangerous to stay, so we took another route towards Parliament House eventually. As we turned around, there were people cheering from the counter rally, saying, we've won, etc. Quite childish displays, I think, from some of the counter rally members. And they actually followed us to Parliament House, so even though they'd managed to stop us for a good 45 minutes, it seemed that it wasn't enough. And they followed us towards Parliament House. And although I didn't see it for myself, I heard that they stood on the platform, which was designated for the speakers, and also had a very loud drum, which was kind of hindering, or it was hindering, all the audience from hearing the speeches. So there was a few people claimed that they were disappointed that our freedom of speech was really hindered in that way. I think there have been counter-protest in the past, but this one was fairly confrontational. There were people popping the balloons, blue and pink balloons of the pro-lifers, destroying signs, burning signs, tearing signs, yelling and swearing. So it was, I think, more confrontational this time around, and it wasn't sort of anticipated. But the pro-lifers, I think, being part of that crowd, did a very good job at demonstrating peacefully. They were very peaceful. Family and friends gathered together. I was with a few friends, basically engaged in polite conversation, tried to avoid confrontation. I was confronted by a few members of the counter rally, tried to respond minimally to the swearing and so on. I think overall they did a good job at getting their message across in a really loving and compassionate way.
This group, I mean, you said they were quite aggressive. They were popping balloons and tearing signs and things. I heard report some people actually were hit to the ground. Is that true?
I did see a few instances where balloons were popped and a lot of swearing aimed at the state and the church. I heard a few chants, which was surprising since the laws are in their favour at present. And I remember I saw a few young people speaking to some elderly women quite confrontationally as well, which was surprising. I found it personally very emotionally challenging. I was not expecting it at all.
What were the sorts of things that they were saying?
One chant that lasted a while was F the church, F the state, women will decide their fate. So a lot of the language was around autonomy and choice from the other side. There were some signs such as F off Christian bigots, and they were chanting also F off bigots. So a lot of swearing, a lot of derogatory language. Contrast that with the pro-lifers who I thought did a good job, like I said, at being compassionate in presenting their stance. Their signs had messages such as support mothers, protect babies, abortion kills one and hurts the other. So change law as well. I particularly like support mothers, protect babies. I thought that is really the line of argument or the thought process that we should be having right now, the fact that mothers deserve support and need support, and that there is a lack of choice in Australia at the moment, where abortion is extremely accessible and adoption is not an easy thing to go through, not an affordable and accessible procedure. So I thought that is really a perspective that the pro-lifer should be taking on and engaging with.
That was Therese Shamoon sharing her experience of the March for the Babies in Melbourne. Abortion is no doubt a contentious issue in Australia and across much of the Western world, and one that triggers a profoundly emotional response for those involved. Abortion proponents claim that the issue is a matter of freedom of choice for women, but Real Choices Australia Executive Director Debbie Garrett disagrees. Debbie says abortion is often presented as the only solution to a range of psychosocial problems that it doesn't actually address. In many cases, Debbie says, abortion only makes matters worse. I spoke to Debbie recently to find out more. I'm sure you've heard by now the news of the March for the Babies in Melbourne over the weekend. And I spoke to someone recently who was there, and there were so many reports on scenes of vitriol and some cases of violence and balloons being popped. There was a lot of anger. Mm. And first of all, I just wanted to ask you, why do you think this is such an emotionally charged issue?
I think primarily because there is this real conflict or dissonance, if you like, about what abortion and choice really means. And so when you look at the spectrum of views, we have abortion advocates who have truly believed that women can't fully participate in their social, educational and professional worlds without access to abortion, because they believe that pregnancy and motherhood is something that interferes with their ability to equally participate with men. At the other end of the spectrum, you have people who believe that women should be equal participants in each of those worlds. However, they believe we should be dealing with the inequities in a different way, as opposed to telling a woman she has to choose between her child or her career or her child or her education. So women actually experience, we know that the research tells us that women don't necessarily experience abortion as a genuine choice. They experience it as something, a kind of a last resort, the thing that they have to do. Because abortion is so prevalent, of course, we've got large numbers of people in the community who have a significant emotional investment in abortion being an okay thing to do because they've experienced abortion or helped someone else have an abortion, or they've talked positively about abortion. So, you know, having an investment in something being okay does create this kind of defensive anger.
I think that point is very true. I know I've been in situations before where I've seen an abortion advocate who has been kind of protesting at a vigil, and looking at the anger, there seems to be more than a strongly held belief. There is a lot of pain underneath that. I mean, considering that, how are we to address this anger?
I think you're very right there, Sarah, in recognising it as an underlying pain, and I think it's almost kind of a collective grieving. The one of the problems, for lack of another word, with abortion is that there is very little recognition of the grief that a woman experiences with that kind of loss. Often women who've had an abortion experience that loss just as they would the loss of any other child, whether through miscarriage or stillbirth. And yet they feel that they perhaps have nowhere to turn. They can't turn to the pro-life community for fear of being judged. This is their perception. And they can't turn to the abortion advocate community because they're not actually supposed to grieve. It's kind of a a loss that sits in no man's land that goes unacknowledged and there's no ability to process it. So we are dealing with a lot of community pain and a lot of grief, and I think what's really important is that we work to enable those women and men, because men are also involved in abortion, the opportunity to tell their stories and to be accepted for their stories, whatever their stories are. At the moment, you know, certainly my experience as a professional working in the field and looking at social media and engaging in social media is that those women who come forward expressing any kind of grief after an abortion are very, very quickly silenced and ridiculed by abortion advocates, who are almost fearful of hearing that there might be any kind of negative outcome associated. But it really is important that we begin to give women a voice.
Just to help us understand where a woman might be at the point where she decides that she's going to have an abortion, I mean, mm-hmm. what are the sorts of circumstances that she might be in that would lead her to that decision?
Yes. The majority, it's women in their 20s, the majority of women who are having abortions, and the majority of abortions, well in excess of 95% of abortions in Australia, are undertaken for what we call psychosocial reasons. Now, in states where abortion is within the criminal code, those psychosocial reasons sit under the banner of mental health, because it's seen that there may be a risk to a woman's mental health, in spite of the fact that there is no research evidence anywhere that abortion positively impacts a woman's health. That's still how those abortions happen. Psychosocial reasons mean anything from, I'm simply not ready to be a mother, I don't have enough money, I don't have enough support. We know that younger women may have abortions, I'm talking about teenagers now, may have abortions because they don't want their parents to know that they're sexually active, or they're scared of the stigma associated with being young and pregnant. And women in their 20s may still be at university, and the universities are not terribly supportive and flexible in allowing them to continue a pregnancy and through the early parenting years. And also, young women are looking at setting up their careers, and they don't have an experience of flexibility in being able to juggle those things either. So they will, you know, look for, a kind of a quick fix is really what is occurring. And it does happen very quickly. Most women have abortions in the private sector, in clinics where they ring, make an appointment, have a procedure undertaken, often on the same day, and with no real opportunity to fully explore their options or to see what other services might be available to them.
So what you're pointing to there is this is a problem that's bigger than anything that can be solved by more liberal abortion legislation. Is there something really lacking in our society? Is there more that we could be doing to give these women more options?
I think there's a whole lot lacking in society. We've had this, you know, real push over several decades now that in order for women to be kind of, you know, and this comes out of this kind of very radical feminism ideals, in order for women to be equal with men, they need to even deny their reproductive capability. You know, men don't have babies, therefore they, you know, get on in the world in different ways. And therefore, if we provide a means for women also not to have babies, they'll also have the same opportunities. And it's a very narrow view of the world that, you know, does deny the experience for the majority of women. And I think what's happened, because of the wider availability of abortion, and it is very widely available, we do have almost 100,000 abortions each year in the country, because of the wider availability, there's almost a sense of, we speak to women who say, well, you know, I wanted to have my baby, but someone said, why would you? You know, why aren't you having an abortion? You know, if a woman is single, or she's at uni, or she's a teenager, or she's has her career, or she has an adverse prenatal diagnosis, there's a real pressure toward abortion because it is It's certainly cheaper for society. It's an easier solution than actually providing the supports that women need in our communities. So it does take a lot of extra effort to support a woman through pregnancy and through parenting. And we're failing to do that. We're not gathering together as communities and providing spaces where women can feel free to continue a pregnancy and become mothers in supported ways. I've spoken to groups of doctors who have said there is enormous pressure on them nowadays when a woman comes in for her first antenatal appointment. She's found out she's pregnant with a home pregnancy test, attends her doctor, and the doctors feel a great sense of pressure to say, okay, so would you like to continue with the pregnancy? There's no congratulations anymore. There's no joy around those beginnings of pregnancy because of the ideology that's associated with it. And I think that's really sad.
So if a woman finds herself with a crisis pregnancy, I mean, you're saying her first port of call is generally her GP, and he might suggest that she terminate the pregnancy. Where else can she go?
Well, a first port of call isn't always her own GP. First port of call is often, you know, particularly in the capital cities, will be the abortion clinic. You don't have to go to your GP, except there's one state that does require a GP referral. Most women can just front up to a local abortion clinic. I think the most important thing is that women are supported to look around at their different options. So whilst it's difficult to name different services in women's communities because they are so diverse, what is important is that a woman understands that she has the time to fully explore all of her options. If she's at university, to see the university counsellor and find out what flexible study options might be available to her, what financial supports might be available to her, what housing supports might be available. And if she's in a career, to ensure that she's fully informed of what all of her entitlements are for maternity leave, etc. There are a number of pregnancy centres around the country who offer material and emotional support to women, but those numbers are very, very few, and they really don't meet. And because they're very few, we're not meeting the needs of the majority of women. So where there are communities of other young mums who can kind of gather together and say, look, you know, we recognise mothering is hard, pregnancy is difficult, being a new mum is very challenging, particularly if you're doing it in a very isolated way. What can we do to help make that a bit easier for other women and set up services? I think that that's one of the most important things that we need to be doing.
So if she finds herself pregnant, she decides she doesn't want the abortion, where can she go? What support is there?
Well, we actually have a website where women can put their postcode in, and it can bring up different services in their communities, including things like maternal and child health nurses and even local Centrelink offices, etc. There are organisations in Melbourne. There's the Carolyn Chisholm Institute. There's Open Doors Counselling. In the Gippsland area, there's an organisation called Olivia's Place. There's also in Melbourne, the Babes Project. In Queensland, there's the Crisis Life Centre. In Perth, there's Pregnancy Problem House. So there are a number of organisations around the country specifically set up to meet the needs of those women who are feeling as though they need much more support. Having said that, in the United States, there are around 4,000 of such centres which open 5 days a week and provide places in even the smallest of communities for women to go. In order for us to be comparable in Australia, we should have at least 400 centres, and we don't. We have less than a dozen. So we are really falling down in that regard.
It does seem interesting that proponents of women's rights are spending more time fighting for abortion legislation than they are for support for women.
Absolutely. Abortion advocacy, it's not about pro-choice from my perspective. It is about advocating for abortion, because my experience has been that those groups are doing exactly that and only that, and that is advocating for abortion services, not advocating for women's rights to other supportive services to express their other choices, namely to continue a pregnancy.
Now, obviously, we know there's another person involved. There's the good of the child. But if just still focusing on the good of the mother, there's different options. She can abort, she can have the child and give the child up for adoption, or she can raise the child herself. Are there any studies? Are there proven benefits on either side? Or
well, there's certainly no evidence that having an abortion improves your mental health. There is evidence, and it's a growing and substantial evidence, that having an abortion can lead for a certain number of women to serious and prolonged mental health harm. Now, it's not all women. It's a small proportion of women, but it is something that women need to be informed about. We know that being a mother has a protective effect for women's health as well, in a whole range of areas, including even suicide protection. Now, the latest publication on ethics and law for health professionals even acknowledges this link between a much greater risk of suicide following abortion than for women who continue a pregnancy. So motherhood has a protective effect for women in a whole range of health areas. So we can say that being a mother, without never wanting to underestimate the difficulties inherent in mothering, do have a protective effect. In terms of adoption, we don't have a lot of research on adoption in Australia, and although there is a bit more interest being sparked at the moment, we do need to be very careful, though, about suggesting that adoption is an alternative to abortion for women at those early anxious stages of pregnancy. My caution there is about the fact that when we compare the United States to Australia on this issue of adoption, we have very similar fertility rates, so pregnancy rates, very similar abortion rates, but there's about a 2,000% higher adoption rate in the United States than in Australia. What that tells us is that if adoption isn't a choice at the beginning between abortion and adoption, it's a choice at the end between parenting and not parenting. We don't really know why at this stage there is a much higher rate of adoption in America. It could be about social policy. Women are much more supported here by our government and communities to parent. So there could be a number of factors involved. But we also need to be very, very careful about suggesting that women considering abortion should simply adopt their babies instead, because what we're doing there is we're buying into this idea that every woman who has an abortion doesn't want her baby. And the research doesn't support that. The research tells us that the majority of women are having abortions they don't really want, but they don't see a way to manage a pregnancy and a child in their circumstances. So I think that that's an area that it needs some more exploration, particularly by those groups who are advocating, you know, those two alternatives are the best. I think we need as much as we can to support women through a pregnancy and to raise their own children and keep those biological links if that is what they choose to do when they get through a pregnancy, but offering adoption at the time of abortion consideration, there's no real evidence that that's a helpful thing to do.
It's a very good point, and definitely I think we need to be focusing more of our attention on this area.
Yes.
Thank you so much for your time today, Debbie. Of course, you've got plenty more information on the Real Choices Australia website, which is realchoices.org.au.
Yeah. Now, we also have another website, Sarah, that you may be interested in, and that's iregretmyabortion.org.au. And that's the site where we allow women to just simply publish their stories of abortion, and it's something that can be very, very helpful for any woman considering an abortion to have a look at what other women's experiences have been in that regard.
Great. Well, I'll definitely jump on and check that out. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks, Sarah.
That was Debbie Garrett from Real Choices Australia talking about supporting women in crisis pregnancies. To find out more about Real Choices Australia, visit realchoices.org.au. And for more talks, interviews and shows, visit cradio.org.au.
cradio.org.au.